As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal.
We've caught up with the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. John Micklethwaite of Bloomberg News, the editor-in-chief, sitting down with the British leader. Take a listen.
China is a gigantic part of our economic life and will be for a long time, for our lifetimes. But that does not mean that we should be naive in the way that we look at our critical national infrastructure, the way we look at, you mentioned nuclear power, you mentioned 5G technology. Those are all legitimate concerns that any government, many, many other governments around the world have. But I've said this many times, it's worth repeating, I am no Sinophobe, very far from it.
Do you think you're the last Sinophile in the cabinet?
No, I expect there are lots of. China is a great country and civilization.
What about wind power? Would you let them buy offshore wind power?
You'd have to look at what was your defining as strategic or critical. But I certainly think that having our trading relationship with China, if you look at it, it's in spite of all the difficulties, in spite of all the sort of angry conversations about or the difficult conversations about the Dalai Lama or Hong Kong or the Uyghurs, and where we will continue to stick to our points, right? We will continue to stick to our views. But actually, trade with China has continued to expand for a very long time, and I think probably will continue to expand, as I say, for the rest of our lives. That doesn't mean that we should be, we should be cautious about how we handle our CNI and about how we handle FDI from China into some of our sensitive industries. And that's why we brought in some of the legislation that we have.
The Prime Minister of the United Kingdom getting to greet those at COP26 in Glasgow. Joining us now, the editor-in-chief of Bloomberg News, John Micklethwaite. I put on a new shirt and sat up straight today for this discussion. John, there will be Johnson.
Great improvement.
Thank you. There will be Johnson, there will be Scotland, and there will also be the hope for a future perfect. Your wonderful book of too many years ago, 2003, we need a redo, John. And I want to talk at the back end of that book about the backlash. You mentioned the backlash of globalization. What's going to be the backlash of climate change that the Prime Minister and others face at Glasgow?
I think that's actually quite a good comparison, in fact. I think if you look at the issue in Britain of heat pumps, which is from a green point of view, people are trying to put in much more kind of low energy heat pumps into their houses. And everyone thinks that's wonderful and green, but what's happening is consumers who are generally quite keen on green things are saying, no, God, these are going to cost, they could cost $5,000, they could cost huge amounts of money. And I think that what is happening with greenery is a little bit similar to globalization. Mm-hmm. It's something that everyone generally thinks is a good idea. And remember, there was an era where people thought that generally opening up economies were great and everyone approved of globalization until it happened to them. Everyone approves of fighting climate change until suddenly it means the price of petrol, or gas, as you mistakenly call it, rises. That's where it hurts. It's when the heating for your house hurts. It's where things that really affect people particularly. And Johnson is kind of caught in the middle of that, as indeed, you can look at what's happening with the Democrats in Congress.
Do the elites know that at this COP26 they have to sell to a public that's hugely skeptical?
I think, well, one example of the elites is Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth, and she was caught on recorder the other day talking about the fact that nobody was coming and that it all looked very difficult. So I think some people are aware of that, but I think in general, no. I think that it's one of those areas where there is a divide that opens up, and you look around the world, every time it's come up, it's always sort of hit the elites harder. You might remember that example a bit ago where Macron suddenly changed the speed limits on various roads, in part for kind of green reasons, and you suddenly end up with the gilets jaunes. There's few things that make people more annoyed than something directly hitting part of their pocketbook. You look around parts of America as well, and the debates now about what happens with infrastructure bills and so on. So I think it's a worrying area from the point of view of a kind of global elite view.
Meanwhile, they are hosting COP26 at a time when there's a lot of questions around how much to open your borders. That's been an issue of serious disagreement and, frankly, a lot of consternation. However, at this moment in time, UK's hospitalization and death rate from COVID has actually been going up after being celebrated as one of the big winners from the whole pandemic. How did he respond to that?
Well, it's interesting. You look at the numbers for COVID, sufferers, people who've caught COVID, those have been rising very rapidly in Britain. You're right, the hospitalization and death rates have gone up, but so far at least as far as you can see, the sort of vaccine protection thing is sort of holding. The current levels, I think it's around 40,000 a day, people are catching it. You would expect to see many more people dying in the rather gruesome way in which this works. And it doesn't seem to be happening because it's really ripping through, especially young people, everyone who's got schools, people we're working with here, they've got people are stuck at home because their children have suddenly got it. And so there's a degree of that. But there is also the sort of general sense that back to what you said earlier, these things to do with opening up economies, people being there. They are taking in COVID, Johnson is going a little bit back to his more liberal roots. In that interview, I talk about the fact that we're in Margaret Thatcher's study. There's a picture of her glowering down on us and a copy of Hayek's Road to Serfdom, a key part of the Tom Keane book list, staring down at us. That was the culture from which Boris Johnson came. And he still has some quite strong libertarian instincts at the same time as that he is, by any measure, increasing the size of government fairly formidably. He blames that on COVID. And he's also trying to sort of, I suppose, do a version of industrial policy to push the British economy, especially towards the north, but towards manufacturing, towards things like that.
The football stadiums are full again, John. The important question, sir, were you at Leicester Manchester United last weekend?
No, very, very sadly, I miss that. My life is happy because I saw Brendan Rodgers in a restaurant.
Did you?
None of this will mean anything to people like
Tom knows.
Keane or Lisa.
Tom knows, John. You know Tom knows.
I don't.
John, thank you, sir.
Thanks, Sam.
Great work, as always. John Micklethwaite there, Bloomberg News Editor-in-Chief, sitting down with the Prime Minister in the UK, Tom.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
I'm delighted to be here at the Science Museum, where we also just heard from the Prime Minister doing a big speech on innovation, and he wants to attract the big bucks around the world. One person who was in the room and who I believe also had dinner with the Prime Minister yesterday is David Solomon. He's the Chief Executive of Goldman Sachs. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a while since we saw you in London.
It's been a while since I've been in London. I'm thrilled to be back in London. It's really been since March 2020.
It's good to be back,
and it's good to be spending time with people.
And the pitch from the UK government is come here, invest, be green, and invest some more. Have they been persuasive? What has the government been able to tell executives?
Well, I think they have a good pitch, but as you know, we've been very, very committed to the UK for a long time. We have 6,500 people here in the UK, and in fact, even pre-pandemic, going back to 2018, we built a new building here, Plumtree Court, which is a $1 billion commitment. We've been growing up, also in Birmingham, where we now have expanded our presence in the UK. So we've seen the UK as a tremendous opportunity for us to have a significant outpost, serve our clients, you know, both here and also provide resources across the continent.
Has that changed at all because of Brexit? We have the energy crisis, there's a lack of drivers. Is there anything that you need to ask authorities to do better or that your clients want the UK to do better?
Well, I think we're at a moment in time where we're coming out of the pandemic and there are a handful of things going on. I think all over the world, there are labor issues that are really a reflection of this transition out of the pandemic. There are supply chain issues. Some of this stuff is transitory. There are some secular trends that we have to watch closely. But I think we're adjusting and dealing with it as anybody else is. And I think leaders here are thinking about it the same way leaders are around the world.
When you look at the UK and, of course, some of these green investments that the UK and the City of London particularly has been really trying to pitch, you've been extremely involved in carbon offsetting. Can London really spearhead that movement?
Well, I think it's important that governments around the world partner with the private sector to try to get capital directed toward innovation in a way that we can accelerate the climate transition. And I want to emphasize it's clearly a transition. We need thoughtful policy. In my opinion, we need to put a price on carbon. And I think this is something that's very important. There's an enormous premium for certain green technologies. We can invest in technology that can collapse that premium and allow us to deliver a much more sustainable future. But this is something that's going to take some time, and I think it requires both good public policy from our governments and then active involvement from the private sector. We're trying to do our part. I think you know we've made a big pledge towards $750 billion of sustainable financing, investment, advisory services. We're working toward that. And we try to spend a lot of time with our clients thinking about how we can support them in their individual transitions. And so this is getting a lot of attention, as you would expect it should.
There's also quite a lot of regulation going ahead. And we've heard yesterday, for example, about ESG derivatives. Exactly, where does that end? And can London as a capital be the green finance capital of Europe and the world?
Well, I think there's a real, we heard very, very clearly from the Prime Minister, a real sense of trying to spur on in this economy here an opportunity to create less regulatory structure and therefore more incentives to spur more of that investment. And there's a great center of excellence in investment here, certainly around the vaccines. There was a bunch that happened here in the UK. And so, I'm optimistic the UK will play a part. But when you think broadly about these issues, this is a global issue. And particularly in the developing world, we in the developed parts of the world are going to have to, help to bring the world along and get capital focused on technologies that can move this transition over time. And it's really, it's not just here or there, it's everywhere.
Talk to me about China. So we had exciting news from Goldman Sachs, I think, in the last couple of days. How committed are you to China, or how wary are you of things changing quite quickly, given some of the economic policies put in place by the president?
Sure. We take a very long-term view. And we take this view, rooted largely in the fact that we have many, many clients that have been doing business in China for a long time. They want our support and our involvement. We're extremely pleased that after a long period of time, 17 years since we started our joint venture, that we actually now have ownership and control of our joint venture in China. So we're thankful for that. We have a long-term plan to continue to grow in China. We've recently announced a wealth management joint venture there. There's no question that the bilateral relationship between the U.S. and China is complex, and it's going to continue to evolve. We're watching it closely, but with a long-term lens, China's an important part of the global economy. Goldman Sachs operates as a global player with businesses around the world that are participating in global growth. And so we think in the long term, that presence there will be very important for us.
Is it riskier being alone, or is it safer being in a joint venture? Like, what does it mean in terms of regulatory risks?
Well, I think there are always regulatory risks in all markets. And I think that, we've shown an ability to adapt to regulatory change and adapt our business appropriately. To the degree there are regulatory challenges, we'll deal with them. The big reason that we like controlling our joint venture is when we didn't own our joint venture, we own 33% of our business in China. Every dollar of investment we made, we only own 33 cents of it. So this allows us to continue to invest for the long term in growing our franchise and our business and serving our clients in China. And we're excited about that. And again, my job in stewarding this 153-year-old institution is to take a very, a very, very long-term view. And that's how we think about it when we're investing and building there.
How much do you want to grow in China in the next 5 years?
I think there's a big opportunity. We've put forward a 5-year China plan. We haven't put the details of that 5-year China plan out publicly, but we run a relatively big business in China, although it's a very small part of overall Goldman Sachs. Our growth is correlated to where there's growth in the world, and there's certainly good growth in China. Access to the wealth of individuals and wealth management platform, given our broad wealth management platform, is something that's very attractive to us. Corporate activity has been quite high there. There's no question that's something that corporates there turn to our expertise in capital markets and advisory services. So I think there's a good opportunity set for us to prosecute over time.
How painful have these high energy prices been in customers in China, but elsewhere in the world?
Well, I think there's no question that we're going to go through a period where there's more inflationary pressure on commodities prices. And this goes back to why, when we were talking about sustainability broadly, I said we have to balance good public policy, you know, with the short-term implications. And that's why it's a transition. If we're too aggressive in the context of how we direct capital or the private sector, that can be more inflationary. And obviously, that makes its way down to the end users, individuals, and the cost of their energy or their gasoline, et cetera. And there's a balance in that. If that goes too quickly, that's something that people are not going to be happy about. And for politicians, that'll be certainly something that they'll have to wrestle with.
But what do you say to a climate change activist that says, actually, we have the energy prices, but it's also a good excuse for big banks, big companies, big finance to delay the transition? So to go through a transition, but actually not as be as aggressive in stopping, for example, funding some of the fossil fuel companies?
I think this is all a balance. And, you know, I've said clearly that Goldman Sachs is going to be in a position where we're going to be doing business with fossil fuel companies and financing certain fossil fuel companies, but it's a direction of transition. We want to be in business with people that are investing in their transition. We want good public policy. I said to you earlier, we have to put a price on carbon, in my opinion, because that will allow us to therefore accelerate the transition. But all of this is a balance. The most aggressive point of view on the transition and the least aggressive aren't right. It's a constructive partnership between governments and the private sector to make sure, you know, we protect our society and get capital into technologies that can evolve and help us make the world greener. And I firmly believe that's something we can do, but it's something that's going to require a lot of focus and a little bit of patience, but with appropriate intention and energy and commitment. And we certainly have that.
What happens if COP26 is a failure?
I don't see it as I don't see it as black and white as being a failure. I know, you know, the Prime Minister was asked this morning, you know, what do you expect and what's a win? I think part of this, and I think this is one of the constructive things about being a part of the session here today, this Global Investment Summit, and I know it will be the same with COP26, you need to create dialogue. People need to have debates. We have to be willing to debate, discuss, learn, and therefore make good policy decisions as we move forward. And this is all a constructive part of the process. So I see the fact that these dialogues are occurring as pushing us forward. I think that's a very, very important part of the transition journey that we're on. But it's not a yes or no to me that there's a win or a failure. This is going to be a process that we're all invested heavily in.
Thank you so much, David Solomon. I want to ask about your music, but we'll have to do it another time. Yeah, I don't know if there's anything
I'm really happy
coming up.
Really, really happy to be with you and just happy to be back in London today.
Yeah, it's nice to have you back. With that, we're going to send it back to you in New York.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more. Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Right now to the parlor game, Subrata Rajapa joins us, head of U.S. rates strategy at SocGen. Thrilled we could get an update here. Subrata, how important is the adjustment in the Fed message? Do they have to catch up where the market is on maybe a slower growth and maybe a more controlled inflation?
Not really. I think that for the most part, you're going to consistently hear the same message from all the Fed speakers that they're probably going to be very careful and cautious on rate hikes. because of the fact that they just don't have enough information on the inflation front for them to sort of guide the markets towards rate hikes. And that's why I think you're seeing a little bit of an adjustment in the two-year part of the curve this morning. We did see the market fully price in three hikes by the end of 2023. And now you're going to see a little bit of adjustment based on what the Fed's saying.
Equities are on a tear. What does that signal to you in an overarching strategy, and particularly in fixed income?
Well, I think that low yields are here to stay. As long as yields are low, real yields remain low, then you have to go out the risk spectrum and invest in higher yielding assets. So if you look at the bond market complex, whether it be high yield or treasuries on the other end of the spectrum, your real returns are very, very low. I mean, in treasuries, you're getting negative 90 basis points. So it just doesn't make any sense to be in bonds, and you're better off investing out the risk spectrum. And that's why you're seeing more and more demand, if you will, for risky assets, as well as corporate bonds and high yielding bonds, in an environment where treasury yields are going to potentially remain low for the foreseeable future.
Subhadra, I want to sit on the Federal Reserve for a minute. The idea here that they inevitably will push back on some of the rate hiking expectations that are being built into markets. Wouldn't they embrace this? I mean, markets are still chugging along, even as traders price in two rate hikes. Don't they want to propagate that because it gives them, frankly, more ammunition down the line to either ease without even moving the rate just by verbal intervention, or down the line, it does leave them the ability to cut because rates will not be at zero?
So I think the way I would look at it is, I think monetary policy, especially rate hikes, is a very blunt tool in this environment, right? You're looking at a very unusual inflationary environment that's driven by supply chain disruptions and labor shortages, higher rents. You know, the Fed can't really meaningfully do anything by raising rates to sort of fix the inflation problem that we're going through right now. So I think the best course of action for the Fed is to remain patient until it really, really needs to raise rates. So that's why I think they're going to err on the side of the caution, because they know they can pivot easily to guiding the markets towards rate hikes if they need to. If they do it now, then what you're going to see is this sort of price action you're seeing in the bond market, where the bond market thinks that the Fed is going to be able to raise rates sooner, faster, kind of front load the rate hikes, if you will, which would imply a much slower trajectory for growth over the longer run. And that's causing this extreme flattening of the curve. They don't really want that either. Steepening of the curve is healthy for a variety of the sectors of the economy. So they shouldn't really be in a rush, if you will, to sort of guide the markets towards rate hikes.
There's also the idea of political risk, that this is the perhaps view of the Federal Reserve as it is composed today. Yet we really haven't heard from President Biden in terms of replacing Fed Chair Jay Powell. An increasing question, if you look at predicted, the odds have actually been going down. What's your view of the potential market risk of turmoil at the top of the Fed?
Yes, there's more uncertainty now than there was probably even a few weeks back about who's going to be chairing the Fed and what the composition of the committee is going to be next year. But broadly speaking, I think that regardless of the choices that are made, I think, you know, most presidents want a very dovish Fed. They want policy to be accommodative so that, you know, so that they see robust growth trajectory and the labor market is strong and inflation is not a concern. So I think broadly speaking, you know, the composition is going to remain somewhat dovish, even if there are new choices made for the chair as well as some of the committee members. So I think that policy, especially with the Fed, tends to be somewhat stable. So I think I'm not nearly as concerned about the change in leadership, if you will.
How does this devolve into the equity market? I know it's off your remit, but the gloom crew, Subhadra, has been absolutely crushed in the last 10 days. How do you adapt to that? How does it change your perspective?
By gloom crew, you mean the people that expect the equity market to turn over?
The narratives, this fear, that fear, whatever the fears are in bonds or stocks, they've been obliterated.
You know, it's interesting because it has happened within the context of the bond market being concerned about very, you know, higher trajectory to inflation, the bond market being concerned about the Fed raising rates. So the equity market, for the most part, is dismissing all the signals that, the bond market's sending on the fact that the front-end yields have gone up with a faster pace of rate hikes. There's probably a potential slowdown in growth. So I think the equity market is going to wait. I mean, I'm not an equity strategist, but I think that really the signal that I'm getting from the equity market is that they want to see and hear from the Fed before they start pricing in sort of this doomsday scenario. And the bond market always tends to lead, if you will, in some respects. So the signal from the bond market is going to be very key for all the other risky assets.
Zubaydah, you are perfectly entitled to talk about the equity market, since equity strategists have spent the whole of this year pretending to be bond market strategists pretty much all of this year. Zubaydah, thank you, as always. Zubaydah Rajappa there of SocGen.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more. Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
On radio out of New York and, of course, Boston, Washington, San Francisco, and all across this nation and truly around the world, we say good morning. And on radio and TV, it's about, okay, now what? Brent Schuette is Chief Investment Officer, okay, now what, at the Northwestern Mutual Company. Brett, what is the mood of your institutional and retail clientele that's worried, cautious, or flat out scared?
Yeah, we think there's been worries in the market since about mid-May. So if you think back then, everything was going well in this country. Everything that we had tried to do over the prior year was kind of coming to fruition. So we had rising vaccination, declining COVID cases, and economic growth was strong. And I think people sat around and wondered what could go wrong. And so you had to worry about too much. Think the inflation commentary that we still have today, and what would the Fed do? You had the too little crowd, China, Evergrande, would the economy roll over? And then valuations, are stocks too strong? Have they rallied too much? And we think that's really driven trading over the past few months. And we think that as you move towards the end of the year, investors will refocus on economic and earnings fundamentals, which will push stocks higher. And I think that's what you're seeing right now. Earnings are coming in strong. The economy is still strong. Certainly there has been a weak patch because of COVID, but I think that alleviates. And I think you're left with an economy that's moving higher, earnings that are strong, and a 10-year treasury still setting around 160. Where are you going to put your money?
How important is that 160 piece in all of this?
It's important. I mean, if you think right now, I find the narrative kind of odd when people come on worried about inflation, saying the Fed's going to do nothing, and then they tell you to invest in bonds. To me, I still think there's plenty of room in equities, I think especially in the more cyclical areas, which I think we've all given up on after a brief six-month rally in those versus things like the Apple $19 cloth that you were talking about.
Yeah,
I think that here and now in oil and places like that is where you want to invest, more so than the secular growers like you just mentioned.
I've been asking guests over the last week, Brent, what are the pillars of support that will persist, we can lean on through next year as well, not just into year-end? BlackRock gave me two. They said pent-up demand, that will persist, and pricing power. Do you share that view, Brent?
I do. If you look right now, for example, on the consumer side of the equation, the consumer has spent the prior 13 years deleveraging their balance sheet. Their debt to net worth has gone from 24 to 12. The cost of that debt has gone from 18 to 12. And so the consumer's healthy. They have pent up demand. And I think you're going to continue to see spending. The question is going to be on these supply chains. Can those snarls kind of alleviate a bit? And I think they will as you move into the new year. And so I think you have a setup where equities continue to push higher. There certainly are risk, and I don't expect the same push that you had post-COVID. But I think on a relative basis, stocks are still attractive relative to bonds, just given the economic outlook and where the Fed is.
Brent, when you were saying that there is a lot of pessimism in markets, where are you seeing that pessimism?
Yeah, for example, just the client visits, the questions that I get are not what could go right, it's what could go wrong. And that's kind of a continual question that I get all the time because things have gone fairly well. But if you look at the AAII bullish sentiment survey, it peaked around May. We kind of had all the meme stocks moving higher. We had people trading on a daily basis. We had optimism actually go above 50, which is kind of rare air during the past 13 years. And it spent the next 3 or 4 months falling to, I believe, 22 in September. is starting to rise a bit again. And I think people are going to get warmed up to the fact that the economy is still pushing along. And that typically pulls markets with it. And I don't expect this time to be any different.
When you talk to clients and they hear from asset manager after asset manager, it's a stock picker's market. What do you tell them? Do you say, look, the index is doing pretty well. It's supported by a number of different pillars. Or do you say, yeah, you should be very selective, or you should just pay very big fees to somebody to invest your money on a stock level?
We attempt to pull both levers. And so we attempt to add value through security selection and asset allocation. So we are overweighted small caps, for example, and we certainly do try to tilt our portfolio towards those cyclical names that I mentioned kind of in my opening comments.
Brent, always fantastic to catch up with you, sir. Very calm and constructive on the outlook. Brent Schuette there of Northwestern Mutual.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.